KZSU, Stanford University. I am Dave Levine. Welcome to the inaugural edition of Hearsay Culture, a show dedicated to the discussion of internet, society, and technological issues. My name is Dave Levine. I am a resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. And this show will be basically a discussion of all things internet, all things technology, with a focus neither on law or on issues involving what many people would call geeks. And by geeks, I don't mean that in the derogatory sense. I mean it really in the sense that it's become to be known, not when I was a kid. I graduated high school in 1990, so that gives you a hint as to my age. In 1990 and before, to be a geek, and I certainly probably qualified as one as I was programming in BASIC on my Commodore 64, geek generally connoted someone who was going to have a hard time getting dates, was going to have a hard time getting out there and doing anything other than computers. In 2006, the term geek is something very different, and it's often something which has nothing to do with one's social state or social status, but rather has to do with the fact that they enjoy technology, they use technology, they enjoy computers, and they're into computers. That transformation is really, in large measure, what I intend to be focusing on in this show and what I intend to look at as I explore these issues on a weekly basis. The goal of the show is to discuss an individual issue. This week, for example, we will be discussing internet gaming with an individual named Dave, the anonymous Dave, who has gone for the last two odd years as a quasi-professional poker player. That will be one of many discussions that I intend to have in the future as I reach out to people in the field, invite them as guests, and engage in a conversation about these issues. So with that background, I should also explain briefly what I mean by the phrase hearsay culture. Hearsay, as an attorney, and someone has practiced law, hearsay has a very specific meaning in the legal sense. It's a statement that is cannot be offered for the truth of the assertion in court. And in many ways, what we're dealing with today with the advent of the internet as a means of extreme and impressive communication, we have to become often the filters that the professional media editors and what have you would have been in the past. As you surf the internet, as you reach out there into the world to try to find information, you're confronted, or the cliche at this point I think is bombarded, with information that really you have to decide is credible or not credible. You have to decide whether the information is accurate. You have to decide whether the information is information that you can rely upon. And in many ways, we live in a culture that requires that level of analysis. Hearsay culture, in that way, attempts to capture that notion. The notion being that with the advent of this technology, with the advent of this impressive means of communication, this impressive means of expression of ideas, we live in a society that hearsay has no longer been allowed to be blocked. It's no longer been it's no longer something that requires a deep level of analysis. It no longer requires a blocking mechanism whereby you can say, okay, this is not something I'm going to listen to. Hearsay is out there, the internet's full of it, and technology encourages it in many ways, and therefore it is up to us to decide whether it's something we're going to listen to. So hopefully with that introduction, you haven't decided that you're not going to listen to this show. And with that in mind, I think I'll introduce today's topic. So the topic today is internet gambling, specifically poker, although it's broader than that. Internet gaming has become an enormous issue of really extreme import, not only from a societal perspective in terms of what we want people to be doing and whether gambling meets those social norms, but also it's an enormous regulatory challenge. The focus today, however, will be really talking to someone who has very unique and a very in-depth understanding of what the internet gaming world is about because, as I mentioned before, he has engaged it for the last 2 years. And before I bring Dave on the air, I thought I'd just kind of contextualize the conversation today. So I went through some news articles over the last month, and I've pulled four articles that I think adequately and very interestingly summarize where we are today. So an article from the from onlinecasinos.com, the headline being Swedish government gets into online poker. The subheading is Boss Media, the logical partner for Swedish Games Corp. Here's the interesting fact about this story. The Swedish government, in almost a if you can't beat them, join them attitude, has opened up one of the first government-sponsored online poker websites. It's scheduled to be launched, and it was launched in late March. The government approved it to be, and this is a quote from the article, the first Swedish gaming company in November 2005, and work being undertaken at full speed to create a world-class poker site in terms of entertainment and gaming responsibility. It's a government-sponsored poker site because ultimately, although the article doesn't say it, but poker and internet gaming is here to stay. The interesting thing, the quote comes from Johan Berg, who is president of Boss Media, and I'll read this one directly. Responsible gaming is a critical factor for the government-owned licensed gaming companies. Our solution is clearly more advanced than what is available on the market today because it creates greater security for the end users as well as for the gaming companies since they gain increased control of the gaming operations. So here you have a government that has decided to enter into the world of online gaming and directly, in fact, operate an online gaming site. Pretty interesting. And it's particularly interesting when you compare it to what's happening in the United States. Crossing the ocean, an article from WBOC in Newark, Delaware, six Delaware bars busted for illegal gambling. This is also an article from late March where the police in Delaware seized gaming machines and cash during a statewide raid of six bars accused of conducting illegal gambling operations. They picked up poker machines, currency, gambling paraphernalia, allegedly associated with the illegal operation of video poker machines. They picked up a little bit under $10,000 in cash. And fascinatingly, one of the owners of the bars, the Bulldozer Saloon of Smyrna, an establishment I haven't visited, and now that they have fewer poker machines, I probably won't. But that bar is owned by former 2004 Delaware gubernatorial candidate Frank Infante. So here you have a situation where the state of Delaware is enforcing law dealing with the gambling machines that are located in bars and clearly taking a very different position as far as where those machines should be than, say, the Swedish government. Take a look at another article, Senators Balk at Gaming Measure. This from the Anchorage Daily News, again in late March. At that point, a legislative push to legalize card rooms where gamblers can bet against each other on poker had been held up in the state Senate because of concerns about the proposal. The interesting thing is that the proposed fee structure for the operation of card rooms would have a license for requiring almost $6,000 in cash up front, $25,000 for an application fee, a $500,000 cash bond, and $5,000 for each table that you want to license. So here's an effort that's somewhere between what's happening in Delaware and what's happening in Sweden, where the state of Alaska is at least considering regulating and obviously collecting funds associated to gambling. But then something that occurred also in late March, and which is getting a lot of attention, is the polar opposite in the state of Washington. The state of Washington passed and the governor signed in late March a bill which is entitled for people that are into poker and into gambling. It's kind of an ominous title, but it's an act relating to reaffirming and clarifying the prohibition against internet and certain other interactive electronic or mechanical devices to engage in gambling. This bill, which says clearly that it's seeking to prohibit all forms and means of gambling except state lotteries, effectively, is designed to update the law given the fact that the last gambling acts that were passed in the state of Washington were enacted in the early 70s into the early 80s where the internet didn't exist. The law, very simply, makes it illegal for anyone to engage in gambling or to transmit or receive gambling information through the internet or any telecommunication system. And in a pretty harsh statement of how far the law wants to go, it designates such behavior a Class C felony. So it's a pretty serious bill, and it's one of the first of its kind in the states, where the states are taking upon themselves what has gotten a lot of attention on the federal level, which is the effort to criminalize or otherwise prohibit online gambling from a federal law standpoint. So here you have a very interesting array of issues. You have on one side Sweden, which is getting into the business, and on the other side states like Washington, which are actively prohibiting the behavior. So with that context, I think what we have is what hopefully will be a very interesting discussion, where we take a look at what it means to gamble online. So when we return from this brief musical interlude, we will engage that discussion with Dave. So, with that said, hopefully on the other end of this line is Dave. Dave, are you there?
I am.
Excellent. Dave, thanks for joining me tonight, or this evening, I should say, as we discuss this issue. And so why don't we just start right off by asking you to talk for a couple minutes, just to give everyone an idea of your background, how long you've been playing, where, any big wins that you've had, people you've run into, but just to give you give everyone a general idea of what your background is vis-a-vis internet gaming.
Sure. Like, I guess, anyone who's been doing internet gaming for a living, I didn't get my start intending to do that. My background really is back in Washington State, a place you were talking about before, where I was actually involved in state government, so this is something we could talk about later. You know, I've got a background. I went to law school, although unlike you, I was smart enough to get out before I graduated. Worked in the corporate world for a while, and actually worked in the legal industry for a while. And as I was doing that, I sort of started to follow the trend in popularity of poker, watching it on television, following some of the players, following the tournaments that they started broadcasting on places like ESPN and the Travel Channel. And I was doing that, I got sort of intrigued. I'd always been sort of a hobby gambler, you know, playing blackjack and other table games like that. So I was naturally attracted, I guess, to the idea of poker. And, you know, the game interested me, and I was attracted to the fact that it was, you know, a game of skill that one could learn and one could improve at. So I started, as I tend to do when I get obsessed with things, I started reading books, I started practicing online, playing free games, and, you know, really trying to teach myself the game as a diversion. And it turns out that I, you know, was pretty successful at it, playing online for free. And I was down in Atlantic City one weekend playing blackjack, and I decided, well, what the heck, I'll just enter this $20 poker tournament, because it's only $20, and even though I didn't know the, you know, sort of the ins and outs of playing live or, you know, what was involved, I thought it was worth a shot. So I sat down with about 300 other people, and as it turned out, I came in second in that tournament that day, won a few $1,000s, and the next day, with my winnings, I entered the same tournament, $20, and actually came in second again. For some reason, I couldn't win them. But in 2 days, I turned $40 into over $5,000. So I thought maybe I was onto something.
Is that a typical turnaround for you?
It's, well, certainly not two second place finishes in 2 days. You know, monetarily, there have been better days and there have been worse days. But I was working in Manhattan, actually, at the time in New York at a law firm. I had been laid off. And I started playing online for cash rather than for free, and it turned out over a very short period of time I was actually making as much money or more than I was at the law firm I was working at. So I thought that, okay, this is something I can definitely pursue as, you know, a semi-professional, you know, avocation, or I could probably do if I really were to put my mind to it full time. And so that's something that I've been doing for a couple of years, and it's provided a nice steady stream of income, and mostly it's just been very, very, very enjoyable. I took the hobby that I had, having watched it on TV, and, you know, just sort of developing an interest like so many people have in this country. You know, the growth of poker has been ridiculous, but I actually had the time to really immerse myself and really study the game.
So
I found it quite rewarding.
So just to have an idea, prior to really entering into this full time, your contact with the gambling world was limited.
It was limited. I had actually taught myself how to count cards and blackjack, and I paid a few months rent doing that here and there, but it had been relatively limited, you know, trips to Las Vegas for bachelor parties, that kind of thing. I really was working 9 to 5 or more, and just doing it for fun.
So let's kind of delve in quickly to one of the most fascinating areas, which is the human dynamic between players online. You know, as a poker player myself, I grew up playing cards against my father when I was pretty young, and always looked for the tells. One of the things I've always wondered about when one plays online is what the dynamic is between the players in terms of communication, but also in terms of tells. So perhaps you could talk a little bit about tells, and also just for those that are uninitiated in the world of gambling, perhaps you could define a tell and then what a tell might be when you're on PokerRoom.com or any of the other many internet websites.
Sure. Well, a tell, as most people understand it, is some sort of physical mannerism that betrays the strength of a person's hand. So that, for example, I'm sitting across the table from you, you say tap your foot in a certain way or fiddle with your glasses or something like that, I'll know whether you have a good hand or not, or whether you're bluffing, or, you know, what I should do based on that physical mannerism. I would define it a little more broadly, because as you sort of tease in your question, there are tells online as well where they, of course, can have no physical manifestation. For example, the speed at which someone bets, the kind of conversation that they're engaged in, because online you do have conversations in the form of instant messaging and so on, the size of people's bets, and mostly just patterns. I tend to play on the same site every single day, and so I tend to play at the financial levels I play at, I tend to play with the same people day in and day out, and there's always new people coming in. But the folks that are regulars, we sort of know each other, and we, you know, people who are serious keep books on each other and have an idea of how people play and how they act, and you can exploit those things over time. So I really find that the notion of the physical tells are terribly important in live poker to be overrated, and in online I find them to be underrated. So I think all in all, it's a game of skill and math more than it's a game of reading tells, but they certainly exist in both worlds.
As someone that gambles regularly, do you find that there's collusion going on in the context of people communicating? How do you sense that, to the extent that you have knowledge of it? How do you think the websites deal with it?
Well, the websites, certainly all the largest ones, take very stringent steps to do that. And if you go to the sites anywhere from, say, PokerRoom.com, which you mentioned, Party Poker, Pacific Poker, all the large sites, they have very sophisticated software that actually tracks games, tries to figure out when the same people, you know, from the same IP address, might be in the same rooms for an uncomfortably long period of, you know, repeated number of times, what sort of chat is going on, what sort of results are happening, so that they can track, and in many, many, many cases, they've actually, you know, banned accounts and banned people from playing on the sites because of collusion. It's also something that's notorious in live poker, you know, particularly if you watch any poker movies, somewhere along the line, cheating becomes a part of it, because there's a lot of drama in that, and, you know, certainly it was a part of the game in the Old West. Basically now, with the rise of the mega casinos and security and so on, collusion isn't really a concern, and when it is, it's generally caught in a live setting. The only risk that people online take is that, certainly for the short term, collusion could be used. There's nothing preventing you and I from being on the computer in the same game and being on the phone telling each other what we have. But what people have generally found, and it's certainly something that I take to heart because I'm not that worried about it, is this usually happens at some the less expensive games. People with more skill are still going to be able to overcome colluding players, because just because you collude doesn't mean that you're going to win. So it's something you find, like in the really inexpensive tournaments, you might discover there's a group of kids from a college or something playing, and sometimes it's just blatantly obvious. But I haven't found that to be a big concern, and most of the people I know who play for decent amounts of money don't really worry about it either.
Do you think it's interesting because poker itself involves bluffing and so many behaviors that would be considered unethical or would suggest a lack of ethics in the real world, and yet in poker, obviously, bluffing is not only something that people do, but people expect. I find it interesting that as a poker player, your sense is that there's almost an honor between the players that while collusion may happen, it's not something that would deter you from playing. But I guess it begs the question, which kind of leads into a little bit different area, which is how much you feel the internet has supplanted the brick-and-mortar poker rooms in terms of the actual play.
That's what's interesting. I don't think it's hurt them at all. I think it's helped greatly because it's online where people who may be a little uncomfortable walking into a casino, like I certainly was that first time, you know, can go and they can play in anonymity and they can learn, they can certainly learn the rhythm of a game or how it's played. And they can also learn a little bit about the culture and feel a little bit better when they walk into a live poker game. When I was in that cheap $20 tournament in Atlantic City, I was scared to death. I remember I won my first pot and my hands were shaking as I was reaching for the chips because it was such a new thing for me, and I wanted to make sure I did everything right, and it was exhilarating at the same time. That online, you know, is something you never have to worry about. And the game of poker has become so popular, I think, as people learn to go online and play, that just drives them to the poker rooms because then they want to try it live. I've certainly never been to, for example, one of the Los Angeles casinos or one of the Atlantic City casinos and not seen them packed and not seen lists, you know, 10, 20 deep for games and for people waiting. So I think that the game has just grown exponentially, as is evidenced by the World Series of Poker, which a few years ago had a few hundred entrants and had almost 6,000 last year.
Do you, that kind of moves us into another question I had, which is just the quality of play generally. Is there any difference between the quality of play, and by quality I mean literally people that know what they're doing, that are making the moves that one would expect of someone that's not fooling around or that's been at it for a while? I get the sense from what you're saying that the quality of play really doesn't differ all that much between the online world and the brick-and-mortar world, or am I wrong about that?
A little bit wrong in that I think it's certainly worse in the online world just because that's where people are cutting their teeth and they're learning. But certainly, again, when they're playing for more money, they fancy themselves slightly better players, generally at the higher levels, then they're going to be better players. But, of course, what constitutes a small amount of money to one person might not to another. So you never know when you're in a game with a complete beginner. But I certainly find, overall, the quality of play online to be quite poor. You know, and the quality in the brick-and-mortar world is quite poor, too. That's how people who study the game and are good at it make money. But there's, you know, with the influx of players, you certainly see some things online that are just insane that you normally wouldn't in the brick and mortar world. And here's an interesting dynamic. Because you have to look someone in the eye and actually show your cards in front of people, you know, there is an element of embarrassment that doesn't exist in the online world, which allows people to make bolder moves, and sometimes they're smart moves and bluff more. And sometimes they can be more strategic, but they can also just be more reckless and stupid. So that's an interesting dynamic. You wouldn't, especially in a tournament, say in a no-limit type of tournament when you can lose all your money, you're not going to do something as audacious, perhaps, live.
Yeah, it's interesting, the audacity of some of the players. I've read articles. There was an article in the New York Times several months ago. There was an article in the Los Angeles Times about it as well, which pictured individuals playing 3, 4, 5, 6 games at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
What's your experience doing that? And again, as a factor, that chain obviously is completely different than the brick and mortar world. Obviously, you can play one game at a time in a casino. I would imagine that the result of that is you might have people not only acting more rashly than they might otherwise, but also just generally not paying attention.
I think that's very true. There's some people who've made it, and some pros even, who've really made that one of their claims to fame, that they can play 6, 8 games at the same time. I think if you're playing more than one cash game at the same time, where you're betting any significant amount of money on a hand, you're just throwing money away, because clearly it's a game that requires concentration and patience. I think it's possible to play more than one tournament at a time, because tournaments, especially at the earlier levels, are more formulaic, and as long as you are not engaged in two hands that are really significant, sometimes it's possible to do that. I've tried, and I've had limited success with it, but you know, overall I find it's not profitable to try to do two things at once.
Mm-hmm.
And I frankly can't fathom how people can do 6 or 7 games. So I think the game demands more concentration than that.
It seems that it would, but it also seems that this, again, is one of those things about the Internet that kind of makes it such an odd tool. The capability of computers to, you know, do multiple functions at the same time is something that's a recent development in the last 10 or 15 years at the most. When bulletin board systems were running in the early 90s into the mid-90s, the idea that you could have 3 or 4 bulletin boards running at the same time was really unheard of on any tabletop PC. But now that the cheapest machines could run, you know, multiple windows through Explorer or Safari or Firefox or what have you. And it's really kind of startling to think that you could have players that are operating at that level of play across the board. So I guess I'm not too surprised to hear that the quality might drop off as people try to engage in multiple games at the same time.
Yeah, I think the exception would be, and I know there are examples of this, professionals who are playing for high enough stakes that it's almost guaranteed that the people in those games are trying those stakes for the first time and they're intimidated by them. So they don't have to concentrate quite as much because they can just raise and raise and raise and intimidate people into folding.
Mm-hmm.
And they can afford to lose some big pots because ultimately they're going to win by just chipping away at people's money. So I see that mostly when there's, say, $10,000 or $20,000 of real money on the table. And almost nobody
Yeah, right.
A professional can exploit that. So that's the one way that you could play multiple games at once, because you know you're not in the business of worrying about what your cards are. You're just punishing people.
You mentioned intimidation, and I think before we take a short break, intimidation in dress in the brick-and-mortar world, and certainly from what you might see when you go on ESPN or Bravo or Travel Network or any of the stations that have professional poker. One guy that stands out to me, and I'd like to get your general comments on it, is Phil Locke. I was taking a look through one of the many blogs dealing with poker, the LasVegasVegas.com site, and came across what I thought was a pretty interesting picture of Phil Locke. For, in the medium of radio, I'm forced to describe something that really is almost indescribable and, you know, would really be much more better served if you could see it. But the general description, which I know you're familiar with, is a gentleman sitting at the table wearing an enormous hoodie that really is can only be compared to an angel of death. The hoodie is covering his head. He's looking down at the table with kind of a sullen look. He's wearing sunglasses. The hoodie just about covers his entire face. And, you know, the picture that I'm looking at clearly shows an individual deep in thought, but also someone who, in one way or another, is trying to make a statement. The question is, in your experience, again, dress at the table, you know, glasses, hoodies, hats, etc. What do you see as the pros and cons, or do you see this as just little more than an affectation for someone that's trying to make a statement and maybe a little off his rocker?
It's exactly that. I mean, what people have to know about Phil Locke, I'm sure most of the people listening to this, because of the popularity of poker and TV, have actually seen him, is that Phil does this because he's about three jacks short of a full deck. He's a genius poker player, and he's got a great sense of humor, and he dresses and acts like he does because it's good TV and because he can. He's not doing it to hide his face. He's not doing it to intimidate people. But there are so many people, and I'm glad you touched on this because it's one of my favorite topics to rail about, so many people who decide to wear dark glasses or cowboy hats that they can pull down, or for whatever reason, you know, a black leather jacket because they think it's intimidating. At the end of the day, poker is a game of skill, luck, intuition. Can I make it just a definitive statement? If you're playing for a game in a game that has anything less than half of your monthly income involved and you're wearing glasses, you're a complete idiot. There's absolutely no reason to wear sunglasses. You're not giving anything away with your eyes. And I see these people all the time, and they see people on TV who are playing for millions of dollars who might put on a pair of shades and a key hand, and they're pretending to be them. And it's one of my pet peeves, as you can tell.
Is there any humor involved in it? In other words, do you see people doing this at this point for laughs, or is it still really something that people perceive as a fundamental element of the game?
It has some sort of history. You know, there's definitely a strain of poker lore that suggests that this is an important thing to do, and I can't quite figure it out because the great poker movies don't feature anyone wearing sunglasses. So I haven't quite pinpointed it, but I was actually at Hollywood Park Casino here in Los Angeles not too long ago with a friend, and we sat down to play a $40 satellite tournament, for a larger tournament, just for fun. And there was a guy who looked like Chris Ferguson, for those of the listeners who know who he is, and he's somebody else who sort of has a look that he's adopted, like Phil Locke, mostly because it's just, you know, something that's grown organically and it's become part of his persona. It's not really anything strategic. And this guy at this $40 table was wearing a black cowboy hat, a black leather jacket, black shades. He was probably 60 years old. And it was the funniest thing I'd ever seen in my life. And it doesn't make any sense. It just doesn't. If you're indoors and you're wearing sunglasses, you better be blind. Seriously.
Well, on that note, I think let's take a short break. And when we come back, I think I'd like to chat with you a little bit about what you see as some of the politics, some of the dynamic of the game that goes towards more of the day-to-day, not only law, but general climate sociologically around the people. So let's take a break, and we'll come back in a minute. Bruce Springsteen with Atlantic City. One of the classic songs, certainly a dark tale of gambling, one that I trust, Dave, you haven't experienced.
Only at the smallest
That's good. That's good, because I think that would probably be a topic for an entirely different show if you had a direct interaction with organized crime and guys down in Atlantic City, which kind of, though, brings me to one quick question for you, which is the culture in Atlantic City versus Vegas. That probably is a topic for another show, but do you have a one-minute compare and contrast?
I think there's a slightly more desperate air in the city of Atlantic City. you tend to get people, I think, chasing their Social Security checks a little bit more, trying to win them back. It's a little bit sad. There are some casinos. There's a couple, the Trump Taj Mahal, the Borgata, that are spreading the more regular, kind of professional, limit games, just like they do in Las Vegas and like they do in Connecticut. But poker is coming to Atlantic City. At the highest levels, a little bit slower. Although they do now host some big tournaments and World Poker Tour events and things like that. And there are some beautiful poker rooms there.
So Donald Trump still has a little ways to go as far as what he's doing in AC.
He does. But although he does have the second best poker room in town. The Borgata is definitely the best.
Yeah. That's the sense that I got when I was actually at Trump's casino last year. They were doing some construction. The Borgata seemed like it was probably the best one as well.
It's the Tropicana where I got my start in those $20 tournaments, so I shouldn't disparage them.
Oh, no, no.
And I really got my start playing in New York City in the card rooms there, which used to be many, probably 20 to 30 operating in the city at any one time. And you alluded to the song Atlantic City. I mean, you never really knew whose shoulders you were rubbing up against there because they were technically not legal at the time. But that's where I and a lot of people sort of plied their trade day in and day out before they cracked down on those card rooms about a year and a half ago.
That crackdown continues with the raids that I mentioned, and the raids seem to happen on a daily basis. In fact, I think I read about one today. This show's being recorded on Tuesday, May 2nd, and I read about a raid that I'm trying to remember which state it occurred in, but basically it was going after video poker machines that were paying out jackpots over $10, which is the legal maximum in that particular state. So it seems to be something that continues in the regulatory environment, which is something we'll chat about here for a few minutes. Definitely seems to be at best ambiguous for the casual player. Yeah, it's interesting, turning to the politics, Anthony Holden's book, Big Deal, which I know you're familiar with, was really one of the first kind of professional poker player books, and it came out really prior to the big run on the internet. But Holden suggests in his book that many poker players are right-wingers and conservative. What's your reaction to that? Do you think that's true or not? And if regardless, what are your thoughts on it?
Well, I think that's probably true. Right-wing is probably accurate. I don't know about conservative. But I think there's definitely a right-of-center sort of pro-individual, decision-making, pro-choice almost, if you will, approach to things that are considered in the society of vice. So I think there's a libertarian streak to a lot of poker players because these are folks that are basically entrepreneurs, and they're responsible for their hourly win rate. They can actually go to work and lose money, so they probably take it a little personally when the government, taxes them at a higher rate than they would normal income. So I think there's definitely that. And all you need to do is look at some of the examples you gave before we started having a conversation about Sweden, about Washington State. These aren't conservatives passing these laws. These aren't conservatives trying to sort of co-opt the gambling industry, they're left-wing governments. And even in Alaska, which is sort of a traditionally libertarian state, bridge to nowhere notwithstanding, you're going to have quite a debate there between folks of a more conservative bent in the traditional sense, in the anti-sort of vice sense, and those who think that card rooms and the like should be legal. It's interesting that you mentioned Washington State, which is actually where I'm from, and where I play in legal card rooms every time I visit, which is quite frequent. It's amazing that a state that is ostensibly progressive as Washington would attempt to crack down on gambling when you can find card rooms every 5 miles along the freeway. But as long as they're either Indian casinos or as long as they're otherwise heavily regulated, it's quite all right.
It's interesting, too, because, vis-a-vis Washington State in particular, you've got a kind of unusual dynamic because you mentioned the Indian casinos, but you also, when you take a look at this bill, which, by the way, the law itself doesn't go into effect until June. So to the extent that anyone's been gambling in Washington State up to now, it would seem that at best you could make the argument that there was no law that applied to you, at least on the state level. But the interesting thing there is that it doesn't seem from taking a look at the legislation that there's been a whole heck of a lot of money allocated to actually enforce the law, which kind of leads to the question of who's going to go about knocking on card room doors, or knocking on one's home door to try to find out whether they're gambling. In your experience, do poker players generally think about these issues? Do you find that people are sitting with sweaty palms waiting for the police to knock at their door, or do you find generally that people are just gambling with some kind of understanding or belief that the law, like I said, is at best ambiguous?
Well, I think it's the latter, but it is probably worth mentioning that when you go back, say, 40 years to when the folks that are now sort of the legends of poker started playing, say, in Texas particularly, folks like Doyle Brunson and so on, you know, they would have guns with them all the time because they were constantly getting robbed or they were constantly getting arrested, and for them it was the price of doing business. Now I think it's the other way around, where gamblers understand numbers. They understand that, sure, I guess the Washington National Guard could break down the door and arrest them, but it's probably not going to happen. And if they did, it would be so silly that you'd probably become a cause celeb pretty quickly. If I could touch on something you said earlier, though.
Sure.
It's interesting because you mentioned, you were talking about Washington, but you could really talk about a number of other related things in a lot of states. You talked about making gambling illegal except for the state lottery, which is another thing that I think goes to why a lot of poker players tend to be, if not right of center, at least a little bit anti-government, a little bit libertarian. There's another analogy to be drawn to, say, smoking, where the government makes more in the taxes on a pack of cigarettes than the cigarette companies do. In the same way, if a government sponsors a state lottery, that's okay because the money is going for something they deem important. But if I want to go and voluntarily play a poker game with you, where nobody's getting hurt, that's not okay. So there's a real hypocrisy with what government's doing, the same way with Sweden deciding to co-opt online gaming there rather than just let it be a free market. Everybody recognizes there's profit to be made in gambling. They just don't want to let private individuals benefit from that. So I think that's another area where the right of center proclivity comes from.
Well, yeah, and so let me play devil's advocate on that one for a little and push back. So state lotteries have always been one of those things that have kind of engendered a lot of concern, because the whole notion of funding government by means of taxing or creating what many view to be a vice has been one that certainly has made people queasy. Not to mention, it also calls into question the financial stability of the government itself if it requires that level of funding and that kind of funding to operate. But gambling, it seems, at least poker, may be something different. And why do I say it's something different? Well, tie it back again to the internet. You're not going online generally to play lotteries. You're not going to buy a ticket online for, you know, Lotto or Mega Millions or what have you. But certainly I've experienced conversations that I've had with teenage nephews and cousins of mine, and we're talking 11 and 12-year-olds who are telling me about not only going online to play poker, but in fact having games at their own house where, when I was a kid, we'd play nickel-dime quarter, and if there was $4 in the pot, it was a pretty big pot. These kids are talking about starting at a dollar. Now, granted, they may be in a, you know, higher financial bracket than many other people, but the fact of the matter is that it appears that the internet has at least played some role in encouraging these kids to play poker. Isn't that a difference between poker and lottery that you know, at least you could argue legislatures should consider?
Well, I mean, I could be glib and point out that there are a lot of gambling opportunities online, from horse racing to sports betting to blackjack, two actual lottery-type games, and certainly the slot machines, and then at least these kids are learning a game of skill. But I won't do that because, of course, it's a concern whenever kids are involved in something and are sort of escaping what would normally be age-based regulation, you know, because of the Internet. And that's the kind of issue that, you know, the Center for Internet and Society should probably work on, and it's the kind of thing that is going to befuddle, lawmakers and law enforcement, I think, as the world becomes more, you know, more virtual and more, you know, connected to the Internet and, you know, more reliant on the Internet for things. But then again, do I want the governor of Washington State deciding what, you know, I could do as an adult because an 11-year-old might get online and learn to play poker? That's the problem. You know, we still always, I think, in public policy, have to look beyond the hard cases and look at, okay, what does this really mean for the majority of people? And is this an infringement on, you know, their ability to, you know, conduct themselves as adults?
I think it's, you know, you're absolutely right that it is something that the CIS is looking at, and I've, as I think you know, I've written in the past on generally the legality of internet gaming, and it's always been something to me that was extremely ambiguous, especially on a federal level, because as the Washington legislature acknowledged, the laws were created prior to the advent of the internet. I also have thought a lot about, you know, whether poker is a and gambling generally is a victimless crime, as a lot of people consider it to be. So it's a topic that I think hopefully, you know, if I invite you back in the future, which I intend to, we could explore a little more. With the few minutes we have left, I kind of want to move to a slightly lighter topic, but to...
You want to play with me, by the way? It's not a victimless crime.
Oh, yeah. No, I think going head-to-head might be something that would be interesting, although I suspect with your experience I might become the victim. But
yeah, they're just willing victims. That's the difference.
Right? Yeah, right, exactly. Well, there's the concept of willful blindness, which you know, basically requires you to ignore the obvious. And I think probably you would have to engage in willful blindness a lot more than I would in order to have a fair game. But yeah, maybe at some point offline, in a quiet way, we could attempt to go head to head. That might be fun.
Anywhere but Seattle.
Well, again, up until June. If you want to try to get a game together in May, apparently you'll still be under the previous law, which, like I said, at best was unclear from what I've read. Some of the new rooms in Vegas, I think, have started to explore more of these virtual ideas. You know, when Caesars recently opened a poker room, I was curious to, in the remaining couple of minutes that we have before we end the discussion and go to some music and I close the show, where do you see Vegas going, and where do you see the online poker world going in the next couple of years?
Well, I think both are really going nowhere but up. And, you know, getting back to legislation for just a minute, I still think we're looking at using, you know, a spatula to stop a tidal wave. You know, certainly people love this game. It's a great game. It's something that if you do it with, you know, to borrow a cliche, use it with your, you know, use your head and not your heart, you're going to do fine. You know, Vegas is expanding like crazy. There's new poker rooms everywhere, from the Wynn, where you can play for $500, 1,000 limits, down to Caesars, where you can play for $1, $2 limits. You know, they're beautiful rooms. They're growing like crazy. They're adding tables. And they're really accommodating the growth of the game. So people who are learning and who just want to play for, you know, small stakes and just go and, you know, sit for 3 or 4 hours and have a good time and get, you know, have a social, you know, setting, they can do that. You know, every time I go, there's more people waiting to play, and every time I get online, there's more people. So I really think this is one of the new national pastimes, and I think that as long, again, as people are responsible and people understand what they're doing and people don't gamble over their heads, you know, I think it's a lot better than if everyone was playing blackjack. It's definitely a game that, you know, that tests your mind, tests your, you know, everything. It's really fabulous. You know, it's a lot like chess in that way, except there's that little extra twinge you get in your stomach because you're not sure you're doing the right thing.
Yeah, well, that's, you know, and that is another one of the really interesting areas in terms of regulation, is what's a game of skill and what's a game of chance. And I think
California has actually, you know, or actually at least for their own purposes, clarified that a long time ago, and it's one of the few states that explicitly regards poker as a game of skill and distinguishes it from others, and that's why the biggest poker casinos in the country actually are here. So that's an interesting model for other states. I don't know if they'll follow it, but they've actually made that distinction, whereas legislatively that hasn't really been done too much elsewhere.
Yeah, it's a difference between really finessing something and just going at it straight on, and I think you're right. California's gone one direction, and then Washington has gone entirely other and just said, forget it. You know, online gaming generally appears to be out. Well, David, I want to thank you for joining me today. I think it's been an interesting discussion. I'd like to invite you back sometime in the future on a future show where we continue the conversation. But thanks again for taking the time.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks, Dave.
We will take a short break and then come back. We will close the show. Steely Dan, singing about what they always sang best, which in anything involving crime, anything involving illegal activities, really anything involving the kind of stuff that would make for a cool song, that was Barrytown off Pretzel Logic. Well, I want to thank Dave again for joining us today on the inaugural edition of Hearsay Culture. Again, I'm Dave Levine, a resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society. As Dave mentioned earlier, I am an attorney by training, but I'm delving into this world and attempting to delve anyway in a broader way. I might suggest that you could learn more not only about me but also about the Center for Internet and Society by checking out the Center for Internet and Society's webpage, which is cyberlaw.stanford.edu. So where are we going from here? We're going to be off next week because Stanford baseball will be on. And then we will be back on May 17th, I believe, 2 weeks, to have another interesting guest to discuss these issues. But I encourage you to, you know, feel free to contact me through the webpage that I just mentioned, cyberlaw.stanford.edu, with any comments or ideas for future shows and any thoughts about the conversation today. Clearly, internet gaming is one of those issues that, and I agree with Dave on this, is not going away. It's one of those areas that I think will continue to be a regulatory challenge, but it's also going to be a challenge from the standpoint of deciding what kind of society we want to live in. And that ultimately is what I hope to be discussing in the coming weeks and months on this show, with technology really intruding, interfering, depending on your view of it, into every aspect of our life. There really is very little, if anything, that you could identify that doesn't directly impact or be impacted by the internet. I've written an article which will be forthcoming in a law review later this year on the entire issue of trade secrets in public infrastructure, from Diebold voting machines to Cisco's routers. And yet again, what has changed public infrastructure, what has changed the world that and the services and goods that government previously provided, and now which is increasingly being provided by the public sector, is the internet, is the advent of technology, is the ability of technology to not only increase the efficiencies of this infrastructure, but also increase its capabilities. So across the board, the internet and technology remains what I consider to be the defining characteristic of modern society in 2006. And I'm looking forward to having future discussions about this issue. So this is KZSU Stanford, and this is Dave Levine, Hearsay Culture. I thank you for listening today. I sincerely hope that you'll tune in every Wednesday, except for next week, from 5 to 6 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, for those of you listening on the internet. And I hope you've enjoyed the show. So thank you very much, and we will talk again in a couple of weeks.